So Lev asked me last week to tell you a little bit about prospects for observing all these interesting things directly using gravitational waves, which have been do not interact with matter, and therefore, unlike light and neutrinos and other things that are easily absorbed, gravitational waves can happily propagate from the very earliest times of the universe. Unfortunately, that same weak interaction means that they're much more difficult to detect than photons and neutrinos. So on the outline, I've divided this into four parts. One I've called the good for this audience, the cosmological production of gravitational waves, and this will be very short since you all know much more about it than I do. Then for this audience, what I'll call the bad, and notice that for other audiences, I reverse the good and the bad here, are the non-removable astrophysical foregrounds. So those are the things, some astrophysical foregrounds you can fit and subtract and look for a background underneath, but ultimately there comes a level that there is a confusion noise. There's so many sources, you cannot remove them, and that's an absolute fundamental limit to what you could hope, no matter how good your detectors were, to setting on gravitational waves in the background. I'll say a little bit that in a future where expense was absolutely no object, it is in fact possible to construct an imaging gravitational wave telescope, just like an imaging telescope, and look at the dark sky between the sources. But this is in a future where price is really no object, as I'll describe. Then there's the ugly. Again, for experimental audiences, that would be renamed the beautiful. For the physical and practical constraints on the actual measurement devices, what can we actually hope to do, forgetting about what we'd like to do or what the foregrounds are? And finally, there's the really nasty stuff, the question of paying for it, okay, which is a rate-limiting step in all of this. Okay, so just to set the scene before we start talking about the wonderful theory, this is the current reality. There are a number of operating gravitational wave detectors, the two LIGO, one in Hanford, Washington, and one in Livingston, Louisiana, which completed their 1 year of triple coincidence run last October. They're currently, the 2 kilometer in Hanford is still operating, but the 4 kilometer, the main interferometers, are both shut down and being upgraded at the moment. Virgo is also being upgraded. GEO is operating almost all the time. And there are dreams in Australia of producing a similar thing, which would be very valuable because it enables much better positioning than one can get with the existing network. And one of my favorite objects, LISA, which is also a dream awaiting money. But there's actual practical progress being made on LISA. Okay, so with that background, let's talk about the production a little bit. So the principal ways of producing them are sort of two general types. One is directly producing them in phase transitions or reheatings when one has a vacuum transition that creates bubbles of a true vacuum in the false vacuum. The true vacuum expands into the false vacuum. When the bubbles collide, you get time-dependent quadrupole moments and lots of production of gravitational waves. And then there's sort of indirect production of these same phase transitions can produce things like one-dimensional objects like cosmic strings. They can also be produced in string theories or brain theories, or dimensionality transitions can happen like this as well. And those sort of indirectly produce objects which flop around and later produce gravitational waves. So coming back to the first one, the direct production in the phase transition, the idea is that you nucleate bubbles of a new vacuum phase. They expand, powered by the release of the false vacuum energy. And if it's a strongly first-order transition, typically, and there's lots of vacuum energy, the velocity is of order c. And a spherically expanding bubble doesn't produce gravitational waves, but when the bubbles collide, they produce asymmetries, which give rise to quadrupole moments in the simplest term, and that produces gravitational waves. And you can do a sort of simple order of magnitude calculation, estimating the quadrupole, assuming all the velocities are of order c, and you discover that the energy density in gravitational waves compared to the closure energy density of the universe at the time the waves are produced is basically just given by the ratio of the size of the bubble to the horizon size squared. And in typical transitions, the bubbles are quite a bit smaller than the horizon. There's some nucleation rate, and lots of bubbles nucleate, many more than one per horizon. And so there's a factor which maybe would be 100 squared here. Now, that's the energy density in the gravitational waves compared to closure at the time they're produced. Gravitational waves redshift just like other forms of radiation. So they evolve just like the radiation in the universe, except, of course, that they're not added to when electrons and positrons annihilate and all other antiparticles annihilate. So the radiation gets bumped up by a factor of 30 or so compared to the gravitational radiation. And so if you follow through, you find that today, given this beta to the minus 2 then, today the energy density in gravitational waves would be about 10 to the minus 5 of order of the radiation energy density times this beta to the minus 2. Now, this is a very optimistic estimate. It assumes that it's strongly first order, that all the vacuum energy is released, that the velocities are of order C and everything, and you can knock this number down by factors depending on the details of your phase transition. And there are many, many papers, I like the ones by Kusowski, analyzing this. And in addition, after the bubble walls have collided, there is sort of a chaotic velocity field, and there's a possibility of turbulent emission extending to lower frequencies after the initial bubble wall collisions. But that typically has a rather steep spectrum. So that was the energy density. Now, what about the frequencies? So the horizon size, if you were imagining that you were producing gravitational waves of order the horizon size, the wave number which just fits in the horizon has a wavelength over 2 pi, an inverse wave number of about a fraction of a millimeter at a TeV, and it scales as the temperature in TeV to the minus 2. So gravitational waves of that wavelength have been redshifted since the universe was a temperature of a TeV to its present 2.7 degree temperature scale. And that means that this wavelength will have been expanded with the expansion of the universe to a scale of order 10 to the 14 centimeters over temperature in TeV. And that corresponds to a frequency of about 10 to the minus 4 hertz times TeV. And here I was calculating the horizon size. If I have lots of little bubbles, there is this factor of 100 or so increase. GS is the G star S is the entropy in the relativistic forms of radiation. So at TeV scales, it's about 100 today. It's 3.3, just counting the radiation, the relativistic degrees of freedom. So basically, that factor is what corrects for the reheating, the additional energy that was put into the radiation by annihilation. So if one goes through this sort of calculation, you find that reheating after hybrid inflation, which sort of acts something like a strongly first order transition, produces rather similar results. So here's the omega of order. Remember, our optimistic number with beta of 100 was about 10 to the minus 9. So a strongly first order phase transition at the Terra scale would be at about 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 hertz, and then energy density omega of about 10 to the minus 10, maybe 10 to the minus 9 if you were very optimistic. If one goes not to the Terra scale, but all the way up to the grand unification scales, then you find that the characteristic frequency of the radiation is more like 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 hertz. And so if one had a phase transition or something like this hybrid inflation, again, you get of order 10 to the minus 9 for omega. But now at the gut scale, horizon redshifted to 10 to the 8 hertz. If you have, in this particular model, they considered also sort of Terra scale hybrid inflation, which was a rather weaker transition, and that produced an omega of about 10 to the minus 13. And this light blue dashed line is the r equals 0.3 upper limit from the cosmic microwave background on single scalar field, slow roll, standard inflation production of gravitational waves just in those quantum fluctuations in the zero point. Okay, cosmic strings are more complicated. There are lots of knobs one can adjust to the cosmic string. So there's the string tension, G mu, and then there are intercommutation probabilities and the size of the string loops, which are producing the gravitational waves. And so there are parameter families. But once again, you'll notice that it's not too hard to get omega and gravitational waves, certainly much larger, perhaps, even the one can get from the direct phase transitions of, say, 10 to the minus 7 or 10 to the minus 8. But there's a lot of freedom, of course, with the cosmic strings. OK, so that's all I'll say about what you all know about. Now maybe I'll get into the stuff you don't know about. So here we get, for the purposes of this talk, the bad, the non-removable astrophysical foregrounds. Now, the first thing to remember is that all the gravitational wave detectors that are currently envisaged basically monitor the whole sky all the time. They're quadrupole detectors, and they have a quadrupole response. So you're detecting every source which is in the sky all the time. Okay, so it's not like an imaging telescope where you can look around the bright stars and look at the dark sky. You're getting all of the light. And it's useful to remember that if you average the light from all the stars in the sky, it's actually much brighter than the dark sky between the stars. So the fact that we can actually put limits and see faint galaxies between the stars is due to the fact that we actually have a resolving telescopes. If we were like the gravitational wave astronomers and just sort of saw pi steradians average, we wouldn't be able to see so deeply. However, stars just produce light. Gravitational wave sources have well-defined signal trains. And so if all of the sources are ones which we understand and can model as template waveforms, in principle, you can go ahead and fit the individual sources. You can see, for example, if the sources were all periodic circular binaries that were not changing in frequency, you would Fourier transform the data in the solar system barycenter. And every source would be a delta function at some particular frequency. You could fit them and remove them and then look for noise in between the delta functions. Now, obviously, if you observe for some time t, your frequency resolution is of order 1 over t. And so if you forget this factor that comes from Shannon's theorem and details of fitting, it's clear that if the number of sources you're trying to fit is larger than f times t, where f is the source frequency, f times t sort of gives you a limit of how many sources at frequency f you can pack in to your frequency resolution 1 over t. And if you have more sources than that, then your delta functions are overlapping in the width that you get, limited by the fact you only observe for a finite time. Okay. So you can't get more sources than that. If the sources are not just delta functions with the frequency, but they have many parameters like a chirp and the mass ratio and so on, or spins and spins of black holes and so on, so you're fitting, say, 10 or 15 parameters, then you do a little bit worse because you have to fit more parameters for each source. And if you have high signal to noise, you do a little bit better. If the sources have a finite lifetime, like if the sources last for 1 second, even if you observe for a year, then if you interpret this as the number of sources that are on at a given snapshot in any instant, then what you should use here is the minimum of your observing time or the lifetime of the sources. Okay, so if you consider sources that last a long time, or at least 3 years, then if you put in t of 3 years here, that means if the number of sources is larger than about 10 to the 8 times f in units of hertz, then you get in trouble. It's an unresolvable background that you have no hope of fitting and removing. So this limit gets hit for emerging supermassive black holes that live in the centers of galaxies and are produced by collisions between galaxies that merge the galaxies, and then the black holes find each other and merge. And at frequencies below about 10 to the 5 hertz, the lifetime of the binary black holes is longer than 1,000 years, and the number of sources is therefore getting up to be larger than 10 to the 8. Sorry, larger than 1,000. is roughly one merger per year at 10 to the minus 5 hertz. That means you get in trouble if there are more than 1,000 sources. So when their lifetime is longer than 1,000 years, there are more of them than that. So there's no hope in doing gravitational wave astronomy looking for cosmic backgrounds below 10 to the minus 5 hertz. Okay. Not only to the fact that it's very hard to get graduate students to do a project that lasts for 1,000 years to try to fit one of these, right? But unless you have projects that last much longer than 1,000 years, we're not going to make progress. So forget less than 10 to the minus 5 hertz. Galactic binary white dwarfs, so there are lots and lots of white dwarf binaries in our galaxy of order 10 to the 8th of them, and below 10 to the 3 hertz. 10 to the minus 3 hertz, they're more than about 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the 5. And their lifetimes are so long that they produce a confusion background. So there's not much hope actually even going below 10 to the minus 3 hertz once you get, if you're interested in levels of omega, which are below the confusion background from the white dwarfs, and I'll show you what these omega levels are. And finally, not only does our galaxy have lots of white dwarfs, but all the 10 to the 10 galaxies in the universe have even more, but they're farther away, and so this background is a bit weaker than the galactic one. We're unusually close to a galaxy because we live in one. And below about 0.3 hertz, all the extra galactic compact objects become a problem. So if you're not in one of those limits, then even if the background is quite large from the sources, you can be clever by individually fitting them, fit the parameters, take a template waveform with that parameters, subtract it from the time series, and then look for your cosmic background in the source subtracted time series. And you can show that if you do that, if you have sources with an amplitude signal to noise sigma, gravitational wave astronomers always use amplitude signal to noise rather than power signal to noise, then you can reduce the residual contribution to the background by the number of parameters over sigma squared. So typically you might be fitting 10 parameters and have signal to noise of 100. That means you can knock the omega down by a factor of 1,000 compared to what you would do if you just naively looked at the superposition of all the sources. So you can do much better by fitting and subtracting the sources. Okay, so here in terms of omega, so this is log omega 10 to the minus 5, and here's the Big Bang nucleosynthetic limit. That we can't have too much gravitational wave, so it would dominate the radiation density of the universe at the time of the nucleosynthesis, otherwise we wouldn't get the right mix of elements. So we know the energy density in gravitational waves has to be less than about 10 to the minus 5, except in very low frequencies that only entered the horizon later. So here are the supermassive black holes that I told you about. Remember, below about 10 to the minus 5 hertz, it's hopeless. And so if you're interested in omega less than about 10 to the minus 7 at 10 to the minus 5 hertz, or 10 to the minus 10 at 10 to the minus 9 hertz, there's no hope. Too many merging black holes in the universe. The blue curve here, below about 10 to the minus 3 hertz, are the galactic binaries. And you see that they're a problem around 10 to the minus 3 hertz, but they drop away very rapidly as you go to high frequencies. So it's really the supermassive black holes that are the problem at lower frequencies. And the extragalactic background is sitting here, this lower blue-green curve, which is, and this one drops quite rapidly above about 0.1 hertz, because 0.1 hertz is a special frequency. It's the frequency at which two white dwarfs orbiting each other are touching. So it's when the white dwarfs merge. So once you get above 0.1 hertz, there are no white dwarfs contributing at that frequency anymore. There are only neutron stars and stellar mass black holes, which are rarer. And not only are they rarer, but they're rare enough that you can actually fit them and remove them one by one, even out to redshifts of 5 or so. So if you have a sufficiently sensitive instrument that you get good signal to noise, you can remove them and fit them. And so they're really not a problem above about 0.1 hertz. And for example, if you got a super advanced LIGO or you built BBO, the Big Bang Observer, you can fit and remove all of these merging neutron stars and get down, even though the actual background level might naively be here, you can knock it down by factors of 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 by source subtraction. Now at around 1,000 hertz, there are a number of unknowns. So when the emerging neutron stars are widely separated from each other, they're effectively point masses, and we know very accurately what the signal is, so we can fit it and subtract it very well. But when you get up to 10 to the 3 hertz, that's when the neutron stars are touching each other, and we don't know the equation of state, and we don't know the nuclear physics very well, so we probably can't make very good templates. So the fitting and subtraction works really well over here, but it might not work so well at a kilohertz. There's also the possibility that there are lots of young pulsars and low-mass X-ray binaries that are largely distorted when they're young, and those could, in principle, produce a significant background, which drops very rapidly with frequency, but might be important at 10 to the 3 hertz. And asymmetric supernovae, in particular the memory effect that's produced when an asymmetric burst of neutrinos moves past us from an asymmetric supernova, that produces a time-dependent step in the gravitational wave. You can think of it as sort of a change in the Coulomb field when the mass of the supernova goes past you, but the spherical explosion doesn't produce gravitational waves, so it's only the asymmetric part that counts. But that term produces a sort of lower limit to the contribution from supernovae. There might be rotating bars for other things that could produce more. And that lives down around here, which sets an ultimate limit of about 10 to the minus 18 at 0.1 hertz and higher at higher frequencies. So that's what the astrophysical limits are setting. Okay, now we get to the ugly part, the real world. Well, it depends on the level. I mean, so for example, so if you're interested in 10 to the minus below 10, sort of between 10 to the minus 10 and 10 to the minus 16, the window is basically between 0.1 hertz and 100 hertz. Right. And there's also, in principle, a window above 10 to the 3 hertz, but I'll explain when I get to the ugly why that one is unattractive for ugly reasons. Okay. So physical and practical constraints. So there are a couple of irreducible things. If you want to build your detector on the ground, or on the surface of the Earth, or somewhat under the surface of the Earth, there's an irreducible noise, which is caused by the fact that if I have two proof masses, which I want to have freely falling over the timescales of interest by hanging them on pendula, one of them will be closer to some moving matter than the other one. And that moving matter will produce a GM over R squared force on that material. And for example, if I have seismic waves on the surface of the Earth and I build my detector on the surface, then as the little ripples move along the surface of the Earth, there's a lump of mass that goes up and one that goes down and one that goes up and one that goes down, and that's produces a time-dependent gravitational field which acts on the proof mass just like a stochastic gravitational wave would. And there's nothing I can do to get rid of it. I can try to model it maybe with careful seismic monitors, but I'm sort of stuck. Compressional waves if I go deep underground, I can get away from the surface waves, but then there's still compressional seismic waves that produce density enhancements and rarefactions as the wave propagates through the rock. And I'm stuck with those. There's a clever idea that if you're working on the surface and it's too expensive to dig down, you could help the seismic surface waves by cutting a little moat around your detector so that the surface waves can't actually propagate. You have an empty moat. In principle, you could probably do a three-dimensional thing of sort of suspending with a weak coupling a huge mountain or something, but that's probably more advanced civilizations than ours to get around the compressional waves. And moats are going underground sort of help by a factor of 10 compared to the surface waves. They also help. There's atmospheric density fluctuations. The temperature of the air is not uniform everywhere. And there are trees and things that air has to move over, and that produces density fluctuations. And that, again, produces time-dependent gravitational fields attacked on the proof masses, and those are about a tenth of the seismic level. And finally, if you happen to have people working on the interferometer, or in the case of Hanford, Washington, tumbleweed sailing over the buildings, that produces time-dependent GM over R squared, and so you better keep them 30 meters away or more, or you get into trouble. So that's the sort of irreducible version. Then there are practical things. Like, if you want to measure arbitrarily accurately, you have to have an infinite amount of laser power in your system. And that infinite amount of laser power will produce infinite heating on your mirrors and do bad things to them, like make them expand and contract, for example, or explode even worse. And so there's a practical thermal noise, which is due to the fact that the mirrors are kept at finite temperature, which might be room temperature, might be higher if they're being laser heated, might be cooler if you can cryogenically cool them. But there will be some thermal noise, both in the proof masses, in the mirror coatings on the surface. The mirror coatings are not the same material as the back, and it turns out that much of the noise is actually in the coating rather than in the body of the mirror. You have to hang them up by something, and those somethings vibrate, produced by Ohm modes in the suspension. And so there's an irreducible thermal noise. But it's reducible in the sense that if you can cool things down to look very low temperatures, you can reduce that. But remember, if you want to get good precision, you need a lot of photons, and so there's this tension between mirror heating and cooling. Then, in addition to the irreducible gravity gradient noise, which you can't shield, then there are actual seismic motions. If you suspend the mirror, the ground is vibrating up and down. And unless you have a very good system of springs and pendula, that's your mirror will wiggle up and down. And the way to get out of that is to have a series of nested pendula hung up by springs with active monitoring of the seismic motion, jacking the system up, and you try to reduce the seismic noise, and often you can do that by 8 or 10 orders of magnitude, and that's important. And then finally, there's the measurement noises. So there's the shot noise. If I want to measure the position of one of these masses to a small fraction of the wavelength of light, I need a lot of photons. And if I use a lot of photons, the fluctuations in the number of photons striking the mirror will cause the mirror to accelerate due to fluctuations in the radiation pressure, and that will mean I won't know the position very well. So the combination of those two things produces a standard quantum limit, and the limit is in quotation marks because it's not actually a limit. If you don't know about squeezing in quantum state, this would be a limit, but if you know about them, you can get around the limit. But you should be warned that it may not be completely trivial to do very much better than this, because you have to set up your 4-kilometer laser system in a macroscopic 4-kilometer quantum squeezed state in order to do better. And we think we know how to do that by a factor of 3 or 4, but maybe not by a factor of 10 to the 15th, for example. Okay, so the standard quantum limit, you just do a classical argument. The photon shot noise limits the measurement accuracy that you can get in some time t. If you have n dot photons being collected per unit time, then you can divide the wavelength by square root of the number of photons you collect. And if you express that in terms of the received power and h nu, the energy of each photon, you can write it, the delta x, like this. The photons have momentum h nu over c, and the number of photons striking per unit time times their momentum divided by the time gives the acceleration induced on the mass, if you divide by the mass of the proof mass. And so there's an acceleration caused. And you'll notice that the delta x that you get here goes like 1 over the square root of the power, but the acceleration goes like the square root of the power. So there's a tension. As you jack up the power, you get more radiation pressure fluctuations that you can measure better. And if you express this in terms of noises, delta x squared t, so sort of power per root hertz, in measurement noise and acceleration noise, and then you realize that if you have an acceleration noise, it acts like an effective displacement, just acceleration divided by omega squared, all squared. You get an effective displacement noise, which has the measurement noise plus the effect of the acceleration in the Fourier space, And you see that we've got a term 1 over p and a term proportional to p, and therefore it's minimized when the radiation power in the laser is circulating in the cavity is given by this value. And if you plug that in, you get the famous quantum limit, h bar over m 2 pi f squared. So that's the effective measurement noise. You can put it in kind of an, so if you rewrite that, if I have an interferometer which is longer than a wavelength, you can write down the strain noise for the interferometer, and h squared per root hertz given by this expression. But it simplifies quite nicely if you realize that usually you build interferometers that work at frequency f, which have a length which is c over 2 pi f, and the reason is that that's sort of the longer you make the, if you have a fixed wavelength, if you increase the arm length up to of order 1 over 2 pi times the wavelength, you're increasing the signal you get for a given delta x. For a given h amplitude, you increase the delta x, so you make it easier to measure. But there's no point in making it longer than that, because then you're looking from crests of waves to troughs of waves, and you don't do any better. So most interferometers are actually designed and sort of have the sweet spot in their sensitivity around for length related to the frequency like this. And if you plug that in here, you find that the SH is just H over MC squared. So in terms of omega, you can then translate that, and you find that the standard quantum limit corresponds to 10 to the minus 15 for a 10 kilogram proof mass times F over hertz cubed. So if you want to do better than this, you'd better be prepared to start doing macroscopic quantum mechanics. And the particular thing is to notice is that if you're interested in f of 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 hertz from gut scale phase transitions, then this is something like 10 to the 21, and omega sql is 10 to the 6. Okay? So if you're looking for a phase transition that's producing 10 to the minus 9, you better be prepared to get a factor of 10 to the 16 or more out of the quantum mechanical squeezing of states. Yeah? Basically, nobody has proposed anything. The advanced LIGO is either, depending on the version of the document you read, 30 or 40 kilograms. The issue is that if you try to make it very heavy, then you need very thick suspensions and you get large thermal noise. For the spacecraft, there's sort of launch issues that it's hard to launch much larger launch much larger masses. So essentially for the interferometers, I think basically much more than 100 kilograms is, nobody knows how to do it. Yeah, so you're certainly not getting the factor of 10 to the 16 out of the mass. Okay, so here's the sensitivity of initial LIGO. So here's the shot noise term. So the initial LIGO is about a 6-watt laser with about 20 or 30 kilowatts circulating. And this is the shot noise term. The radiation pressure noise, which would be, so this bottom would be sort of the quantum limit, is actually not important because the suspensions that are holding the proof mass are such a large source of noise in the initial LIGO. You can see that the proof mass is their thermal noise. It's coming in just a little bit underneath the current limit. And here's the gravity gradient noise. So if you could improve the seismic isolation and get rid of the suspension noise, you could actually do very much better. And that's basically what advanced LIGO proposes to do. And it also proposes to improve the shot noise by using higher laser power. And advanced LIGO basically comes close to being quantum limited. It's actually proposed to do about a factor of 2 better than the standard quantum limit for advanced LIGO. But the current one, which is operated, is not. LISA, the laser interferometer space antenna in space that I'll talk about later, is very far from quantum limited. It's at 10 to the minus 3 hertz, and so it's orders of magnitude away from the quantum limit. And the Big Bang Observer, a sort of futuristic mission that would operate around 0.1 hertz, sort of in between LISA's 10 to the minus 3 hertz and the ground-based 100 hertz interferometers, BBO is actually getting within a factor of 10 or so of the quantum limit. Now, there are a couple of papers which have actually set limits at the 10 to the 8 hertz, which is of interest for gut scale inflations and phase transitions. But both papers very cleverly give the things in terms of h. They say, look, we can measure h of 10 to the minus 14. The bad news is the actual measurement limit, if you translate it into omega, says that omega gravitational waves is less than 10 to the 32, which is perhaps we could have already guessed without doing the experiment. And there's a recent paper last October proposing a 1 meter quantum limited interferometer, which if you work really hard will get you to omega less than 10 to the 20. Okay, so that's the state of the art. This one hasn't been built. This one's actually been done. And here's the standard quantum limit curve. That was that standard quantum limit term that I put here, and you can notice that it goes up to the roof here. And I think there's really no hope, unless we do very much better on macroscopic quantum mechanics, that we're going to measure this sort of 10 to the 8th hertz. On the other hand, seeing terascale hybrid inflation, seeing first order phase transitions anywhere from TeV up to sort of 10 to the 5 TeV, all of that is within range. Cosmic strings, cosmic superstrings, all of those things are in range. But gut scale, I don't think so. Okay, here's advanced LIGO, just showing the quantum limited performance. This is the red curve here, and the black curve is the design specification for advanced LIGO. This is the existing LIGO in blue up here. And you can see that advanced LIGO is really limited by the thermal noise and the test masses and the quantum mechanics, the fact that it has to squeeze states a little bit. Okay, now to the nasty details. Okay, so what's happened? So the initial LIGO was built, and it worked, and it got to the design specifications, practically. And it operated in over a space of about 2 years. They got 1 year of coincidence data between the two Hanford interferometers and the Louisiana interferometer. Some of the data was taken in conjunction with GEO-600 and the initial Virgo, but they're much less sensitive than the LIGO. And that run ended in October 2007. And LIGO is currently standing down and getting bigger lasers and better suspensions put in so it can improve performance by about a factor of 2.5 in amplitude sensitivity. And the plan is that it will turn on sometime in the middle of next year and do another 1 year triple coincidence run with the improved sensitivity. So that's a factor of roughly 10 in omega, 2.5 in amplitude sensitivity. So to just say the coincidence data for LIGO S5 has not yet been analyzed and published, so I can't tell you the answer. The S4 run, which was a much shorter sort of less than 1 month run at a lower sensitivity, produced a limit on omega of about 6 by 10 to the minus 6, and probably 6 by 10 to the minus 5. In the S5 run, probably we'll get down to a few 10 to the minus 6 in the limit on omega around 100 hertz. The enhanced LIGO will do, again, about a factor of 10 better still than that, so down to a few 10 to the minus 7 in omega. Virgo is also being upgraded to stay competitive with enhanced LIGO. And this year, despite the disasters in federal funding, advanced LIGO actually got $50 million to start actually building stuff. There's already stuff being built in England and Germany for advanced LIGO, the laser system and the suspension systems. Now there's money for the US upgrade. And that one plans to be about 10 times more sensitive, so a factor of 100 in omega compared to the initial LIGO. An improvement to GEO has also been funded. So these are funded in the sense that the first year's money has been paid. That has to continue for another 4 years or so to actually finish the job. So we'll have to see if Congress continues supplying $50 million a year for the next several years. But at least this year they did the right thing. LISA is in a funny state. So NASA, in its great wisdom, has decided that astrophysics is not interesting, but the moon is interesting. Sending people up in big rockets is interesting, and observing the Earth is interesting. And so the NASA astrophysics budget has been cut by about 30% per year for the foreseeable future. And as a result, basically nothing will get built except the James Webb Space Telescope. There's nothing else happening in NASA for the next decade. So LISA was created in the US, then it became a European mission, then it became a joint US-European mission, and now Europe is probably will have to carry the ball on LISA until new administrations and new priorities, we hope, come into NASA. But perhaps is not a great prospect for funding LISA in the next several years. However, LISA Pathfinder, which is a technology demonstration for LISA, which is not sensitive to gravitational waves, but has all of the LISA technologies, actually is being built. The spacecraft actually exists, the hardware actually exists, being put together and integrated, and it will launch in the late 2010, perhaps. And the hope is that at least Europe would start using the team which knows how to construct LISA Pathfinder to start making LISA, which would be very similar. So the technologies for LISA require that you have a freely floating proof mass in the center of the spacecraft, and the spacecraft has to be able to maneuver so it doesn't bump into the proof mass, which is the mirror off which you're reflecting the laser, the interferometer light to detect the gravitational waves. So you have to demonstrate that you can actually drag-free fly a spacecraft with the proof mass floating in the center, which GPB has sort of done, but not actually measuring the position. And then there's the laser interferometer to actually measure the proof mass and demonstrate that there are no spurious forces acting on the proof mass, magnetic or gas or other forces that would confuse you and prevent you from getting down to the desired sensitivity for LISA. So it's essentially, you can't really do that on the ground because there are too many sources of noise, so you have to do it in space. And the Pathfinder will basically demonstrate that you can have a proof mass which is sufficiently disturbance-free that it would actually work for LISA. And the hardware is basically the LISA hardware, except it's just one spacecraft instead of three spacecraft, a smaller laser and so on. Okay, so LISA, I think, could be a reality if the money turned on. It could launch in 2017, but the money hasn't turned on yet. And the final category are things that I would call sort of dreams under study. The Big Bang Observer, which I led a study of, DESIGO, which is a Japanese one, which is made a little bit less well-studied than DBO, and the new ground-based initiative in Europe, which has Study Mundi under the European Union Framework 7 program, to study advanced LIGO, basically. Okay, so here is sort of what's actually been demonstrated. So these are Virgo, Geo, and the two LIGO Hanford and LIGO Louisiana sensitivity curves as they operated during the S5 run. So the initial LIGO, as I said, the existing limits are a bit worse than this, but when the S5 run comes out, it should get to about 10 to the minus 6. And this table, I think, is probably the bottom line which this audience would like to know about. So here's the omegas that one will reach with initial LIGO, with the enhanced LIGO, which will turn on next year and produce data maybe in 2010. And then the data will be analyzed at the end of 2010. Advanced LIGO, which is starting to get built, can get to 10 to the minus 9 in omega. So that's starting to get sort of interesting. If there was a strongly first-order phase transition that happened around 100 hertz, LIGO, advanced LIGO has the hope of seeing it sometime after 2014 or so when it turns on. LISA can get to 10 to the minus 12 at much lower frequency, 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 2 hertz. And as I said, that will happen sometime more than 10 years from now. The Einstein telescope, which is an underground advanced LIGO cryogenic 4 degrees Kelvin, 10 kilometer arms, in principle could get to about 10 to the minus 12, again in the similar 100 hertz frequency range as all the other ground-based interferometers, again perhaps optimistically 2018 plus. And the successor to LISA with bigger mirrors, bigger lasers, and better in every way is a Big Bang Observatory in space, and that can get to omega of 10 to the minus 17 at around 0.1 hertz, and that might be my retirement project. Okay, so here's just a summary of some of the LIGO interferometers, initial, enhanced, and advanced. So currently we've used 6-watt lasers, 20 or 30 kilowatts circulating, 10 kilogram mirrors. Enhanced LIGO bumps up the power by about a factor of 5, improves the mirror suspension, and is probably limited by the coating thermal noise. Advanced LIGO has a megawatt of circulating power inside there. And the mirror heating is a serious worry. It has not clearly been demonstrated that you can actually keep the shapes of the mirrors. The mirrors are very carefully shaped, but the heating is not uniform because there's a beam shape across them, so the center gets heated more than the edges. And well, there have been some recent experiments showing that bad things happen, so probably you'll have to put heaters around the mirrors to counteract the laser heating. 40 kilogram mirrors, active seismic suspension, many pendula, and advanced LIGO. It turns out it's fairly simple to get a sort of simple version of both squeezing of states and reducing the back action from the radiation pressure at low frequencies, so you can actually get below the quantum limit at both high and low frequencies. Okay, so there is initial LIGO. Yeah? Oh, these are the suspension modes. Remember, they're wires and they're sort of violin modes of notes and suspension. So they're extremely narrow, so they actually don't affect, if you were looking for a background, for example, you just cut them out and they're not a significant source of noise. So here's initial LIGO, enhanced LIGO, and advanced LIGO, which you notice is so theoretical that it has no suspension modes. And this sort of shows the breakdown in advanced LIGO, sort of showing the quantum noise, the mirror coating thermal noise, and in the light blue here is the sort of irreducible gravity gradient noise, which basically means that you can't work much below about 3 hertz from the ground. Just to show you the huge difference in the seismic noise, between initial LIGO and advanced LIGO at 10 hertz by active suspension, multiple pendula, proposing to reduce the seismic noise by an impressive factor of 10 to the ninth. And there's a mock-up in geo of the suspension system to enable that. Okay. So the Einstein telescope, the sort of grand vision of the ground-based gravitational wave community, since advanced LIGO is practically done now, we might as well think about the next stage. So as I said, the design study has been funded in Europe. In the plan, this is not, it's called an Einstein telescope, but it actually is at least in the sort of LIGO way of counting something like 12 LIGOs. Okay, because they want to measure both polarizations. LIGO measures one polarization of gravitational waves, so you need to have either a triangular arm like LISA or BBO, or else have two arms at 45 degrees at each site. And then they want to have 4 of them around the world so they can get positional information for the sources. And if you want to do correlations for background, then you need to have 2 of them that are within a wavelength of each other. So it's quite a lot. Arms are proposed to be 10 kilometers long, but they're not sitting on the ground like the existing ones. They're tunneled underneath a mountain or underground somewhere, so the civil engineering costs will be non-negligible. To get around that thermal noise, which is limiting advanced LIGO, they're hoping to cool the mirrors to 4 degrees Kelvin, and do lots and lots of squeezing of quantum states. And the result of all that dream work is that you just do a factor of 10 better than advanced LIGO, and that corresponds to a factor of 100 better in correlated omega. So this is a dream, right? Nobody actually knows how to do this, really. Now, why go bother going into space? Well, the answer is, remember that omega goes as f to the minus 3, and so you do a lot better going to lower frequencies in terms of omega, and there are lots of interesting things like terascale phase transitions that ought to happen well below 1 hertz, and because of the gravity gradient noise, you have to get out away from the Earth. So you need to go to space, and that's LISA and BBO. So here are the parameters of LISA and BBO. LISA is arms of 5 million kilometers compared to 4 kilometers, right? So in space, there's lots of space, so no problem making 5 million kilometer arm length. That's a 30th of the distance between the Earth and the Sun. Only a 1 watt laser, sort of telescope yay big. You collect about 10 to the minus 10 of the photons, but that's enough to get you down to the interesting levels of sort of picometer per root hertz resolution. BBO is working in ultraviolet lasers, 300 watts in each arm, 100 times shorter arm length, because I'm interested in 100 times higher frequency, 2.5 meter mirrors, so each laser is going out through something a bit bigger than Hubble Space Telescope, but much lighter, so more like the JWST mirrors. And BBO, again, rather than picometer per root hertz, is getting down to sort of tens of attometer per root hertz. So, see, it really exists. There it is. Needs a lot of solar panels to run those two 300-watt lasers. 10% efficiency, so 6 kilowatts of electric power. And the solar plasma, the reason this is done in the ultraviolet is because the solar plasma produces correlated variations in the arm, in the optical path length. And because that goes as frequency to the minus 2, you can get it to work if you go to the ultraviolet, but when you want to do correlations to reduce the omega, rather than just looking at the instrument noise, but actually correlating two interferometers to beat down below the instrument noise, then you have to remove that, and that's done with radio waves, which measure the solar plasma and then extrapolate to produce a corrected version. It's not done with LISA, and it's not necessary for LISA because you're not interested in such small values. And BBO, I guess I should also say, in the Deluxe version, it has not just one triangle like LISA, but it has two triangles, so you can correlate two triangles in the Star of David. You can correlate the signals of the two interferometers to beat down the gravitational wave background below the instrument noise. And then if you want to subtract the sources, individual sources, accurately to get down to that level, then you need good positions, so you fly two more of them. So this ain't cheap. 10 billion, 15 billion, something like that. But if you do it, here are the individual neutron stars and black holes. You can subtract their background and get down in a correlated interferometer to omega of a few 10 to the minus 17. Okay, and I'll stop with the summaries for you all to copy down as you think.
I mean,
it's certainly interesting to look at. It's not clear to me that it does, I mean, that there's any hope. Again, there's a quantum limit that applies with atom interferometry as well. And of course, you can get to shorter wavelengths, so you don't need so many, but the momenta can be high. It's not clear to me that one gets anywhere close to these levels, at least none of the systems I've looked at are interesting. That's right. I mean, in principle, if you can sort of, again, you still need an enormous amount of squeezing of states, and perhaps it's easier to do with atoms than photons. I don't have any brilliant insights as to better ways of doing that, and it's certainly worth following. Well, I mean, bars, of course, can work at high atom interferometers. I mean, all of them have a similar sort of quantum limits in the sense that basically what you're trying to do is you're trying to make a very precise position measurement. And the uncertainty principle says that however you do that, you always introduce some back reaction on it. And you can avoid it by squeezing the states, by sort of appropriately designing the states. And then the question is just whether, you know, people have demonstrated sort of macroscopic squeezings at the level of 5 dB or so, and we think we know how to do that. But if you're interested in, you know, factors of 10 to the 10th or more, I think nobody really has any idea. It's not necessarily impossible, it's just nobody has a clue how to do it, really. Right, and you and there's a strong new cube. No, so all of these are doing it on the cheap, right? So the way you would produce an imaging gravitational wave detector is you make a phased array. So every wavelength over 2 pi, you put a LIGO or a BBO or something, and you tile the solar system with them. And then you synthesize the image. Well, I mean, you can certainly use a single mass to sort of do 2 or in principle 3 axes, but I mean, that just sort of buys you a factor of 3, I think. Well, no, because I mean, it tells you about polarization of the gravitational waves. I mean, that's what the LISA and LIGO, right. So if K is sort of the wave is coming in this way, you can either vibrate this way or circularly if it's circularly polarized. So in various versions of the space interferometers, like in BBO, for example, there's a single proof mass that's used to measure 2 polarizations. In that way. But that buys you the factor of 2. But for the imaging, what you really want to do is you want to do a, you know, something better than the VLA or the SKA or something, a real phased array to image. And that would only be necessary. I mean, as long as the sources are well understood, you can synthesize. You basically, as the spacecraft or the Earth orbit the sun, you get position information from the orbit and can synthesize it. But if the sources are complicated and you can't model them, then imaging would be the only way to go. But that requires a lot more interferometers than we're currently paying for.